International Comparative International Studies and Education, is that correct?
Something
is that
like
close?
That.
I'm sorry. He lives here in Irvine, in Irvine, Third Ward, in the Irvine Stake. And I will turn the time over to Newell now. And we will, if there's time left over, we'll open it up for questions.
Yeah, it's nice to be on a session with David. I've gotten to know him a little bit and his work, and that's the nice thing about these Sunstone Symposiums. It helps you to become acquainted with other scholars and other individuals that are interested in various historical topics. I'm always glad to see that they have a certain number of his of sessions that deal with history, being a historian and a political scientist. This is the 10th Sunstone Symposium I've been to. I've been to all 10 of them that they've had here in California. They started at the first one was up in Berkeley in 1987. So I guess next year will be this is the 10th symposium, but next year will mark the 10th anniversary. And I was telling Mike I couldn't believe that that I've been at this for that long. The public image of David O. McKay, ninth president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is overwhelmingly positive. Impressive in his physical appearance, with a large frame, McKay stood 6'1" tall, making him the tallest church president since Joseph Smith. According to one newspaper account in the early 1960s, when McKay was elderly, McKay, even as an elderly man, appeared vigorously and well-preserved, with his massive, well-groomed mane of white hair and handsome face. Giving further credence to this positive image were McKay's many accomplishments, first as a member of the Council of the Twelve, and then as church president. McKay's call to the apostleship at the extraordinarily young age of 32 came in the wake of an already impressive record of church service, most notably as a member of the Weber Stake Sunday School Superintendency, wherein he inaugurated a number of innovative reforms in teaching and curriculum. Also, as principal of the Weber Stake Academy, he presided over that church institution's growing enrollment and physical plant expansion. As an apostle, McKay implemented his highly successful program of Sunday school curriculum reform on a church-wide basis. In 1920, McKay undertook a one-year tour of various Latter-day Saint missions and schools throughout the world. And in 1922, he was appointed president of the European Mission. This meant living abroad in Liverpool, England for 2 years. These latter two assignments were crucially important in making McKay sensitive to Mormonism's potential as an international religion. McKay's 19-year tenure as church president, commencing in 1951, resulted in a number of significant milestones. Total church membership increased almost threefold, from 1.1 to 2.9 million. During this same period, the number of stakes increased from 184 to 500. In keeping with McKay's basic creed that every church member is a missionary, the number of missionaries increased from 2,000 to 13,000. Also, the church undertook an extensive building program, completing more than 3,700 structures, including 5 temples, 2 of them here in California and 3 abroad, in Switzerland, New Zealand, and in England. Completion of these latter 3 temples further underscored McKay's fundamental commitment to church growth abroad. In addition to his numerous accomplishments as church leader, David O. McKay's positive public image is further evidenced in his behavior relative to family and home. Throughout his tenure as church president, McKay effectively presented himself as a loving husband to his wife, Emma Ray Riggs, and devoted father to his 7 children. McKay's family symbolized the ideal role model for all Latter-day Saints. The importance that McKay placed on home and family is underscored in his oft-quoted statement that, quote, no other success can compensate for failure in the home, unquote. Along with concern for family, McKay vigorously promoted the concept of service to others, a responsibility of primary importance, taking priority over individual achievement and self-aggrandizement. McKay stated, "We live our lives most completely when we strive to make the world better and happier. It is to deny self for the good of others." He was fond of quoting the New Testament verse, "He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." Matthew 10:39. Thus, McKay promoted both family and service as essential virtues. But beyond these ideals, McKay reflected certain other attributes and related behavior, less public and frequently less idealistic. David O. McKay's concept of family was based on strongly held principles of self-control and self-discipline. Lack of self-control is the greatest source of unhappiness in the home, McKay asserted, noting that children should be taught self-control, self-respect, and respect for others. Discipline within the McKay home was based on expectations, recalled oldest son David Lawrence McKay. Father never used physical punishment on any of us, but he had a firm rule: never repeat a clear command. Scolding was not a part of his repertoire. Father never talked much. He just looked, and we knew. The look, as it was termed, generally had the desired effect. Such discipline was also coupled with high expectations. As David Lawrence recalled, Father expected the best, and no one ever wanted to disappoint him. Self-control and self-discipline were essential hallmarks in David O. and Emma Ray's own relationship. They never argued openly or in front of the children, preferring to settle all matters of disagreement or controversy in private. Quote, "I never heard my parents disagree, let alone quarrel," recalled David Lawrence. Such restraint was keeping with David O's strong conviction that, quote, "A married couple ought never to speak in loud tones to each other unless the home is on fire." David O. had a fundamental advantage in all aspects of their relationship. Physically, he towered over his almost petite 5'3" wife. More important, as the male, his status as head of the family was undisputed, in conformity with the prevailing mindset of Mormon patriarchy. Emma Ray summed up her subordinate relationship in the following revealing manner. Quote, "Peace in the home is really a woman's responsibility. And if she wants happiness, she must work for it, yes, and pay for it too, by being at all times kind, loving, self-sacrificing, ready to help, ready to serve, in fact, loving to do anything the head of the house desires, because his desires are also hers," unquote. Such strongly held McKay family attributes of self-control and self-discipline were the products of a complex set of factors, some of which transcend and predate the January 1901 marriage of David O. and Emma Ray McKay. A primary factor was the strong lingering influence on David O. of his parents, David and Jeanette Evans McKay. The elder McKay, a native of Scotland, had immigrated to Utah in 1859, ultimately settling in Huntsville, a high mountain community located some 10 miles east of the city of Ogden. David McKay met and married Jeanette Evans, the daughter of Thomas and Margaret Powell Evans, natives of Wales. Jeanette had grown up in Ogden in fairly comfortable circumstances, thanks to her father's success as a large landowner and landlord. Following their marriage, David and Jeanette settled in Huntsville, where they prospered economically, thanks to timely investments in agricultural land and livestock. Economic success made David McKay a community leader, both politically and ecclesiastically, the latter reflected in his appointment as bishop of the Huntsville ward. It also enabled David and Jeanette to build the spacious 14-room house in which David O. was born and which still stands today in the center of Huntsville. The significant success of David and Jeanette McKay did not come by chance, but was the product of two strong-willed, highly motivated individuals seeking to provide adequately for their large family of eight children who reach maturity, the oldest being David O. The elder McKay has been described as somewhat of a martinet, reflecting the very rigidly disciplined Victorian environment in which he was raised. His own family was very structured, very disciplined, and very motivated. The elder McKay clearly embodied the spirit of the McKay family motto as emblazoned on the family coat of arms, Manu Forte, literally meaning with a strong hand, a concept embraced in turn by son David O. McKay. David O. was also influenced as much, if not more, by his equally strong-willed mother. Described by contemporaries as a woman of exceptional beauty, Jeanette had an equally striking personality. Quote, though high-spirited, she was even-tempered and self-possessed. Her dark brown eyes immediately expressed any rising emotion, which, however, she always held under perfect control. A vivid demonstration of Jeanette's strong will was evident in the fact that her husband, David, never practiced polygamy, despite being bishop of the Huntsville ward. When asked why he never entered into plural marriage, David McKay simply replied, quote, you do not know my Jeanette, unquote. Thus, this handsome, soft-spoken, but strong-willed woman bore the distinction of being the only Mormon bishop's wife who did not have to share her husband with another woman. David was extremely solicitous of Jeanette's welfare in other ways. He refused to let her work in the fields and insisted on obtaining help for her in the house. In alluding to his mother's influence years later, David O. recalled that, quote, her influence and beauty entwined themselves into the lives of her sons and daughters as effectively as a divine presence, unquote. In addition to the strong influence of both parents, young David O. was strongly affected by the pervasive presence of Mormonism. David O., however, was ambivalent concerning his Mormon faith initially. He confessed to being a roguish boy, and years later referred to his extreme, quote, extremely active, somewhat reckless days of youth. McKay expressed gratitude, quote, for the wise and careful guardianship and training of noble parents, which kept me from turning to paths that would have ended in an entirely different kind of life, unquote. More to the point, David O. confessed to being a doubting youth, but at the same time, young David O. possessed an intense desire to receive a manifestation, quote, of the truth of the restored gospel, unquote. This caused the youth to pray, quote, fervently and sincerely that God would declare to me the truth of his revelation to Joseph Smith, unquote. McKay was disappointed, however, at the response, or rather the lack thereof, lamenting, quote, no spiritual manifestation has come to me. If I am true to myself, I must say I am just the same old boy I was before I prayed, unquote. McKay's doubts persisted even as he reached adulthood and completed his education at the University of Utah with a bachelor's degree in 1897. McKay's ambivalence was evident in the response to his mission call to Scotland immediately following graduation. McKay, according to one close family member, was upset with this interruption in his plans, having been offered a teaching position in Salt Lake County. Upon receiving written notification of his mission call, David O. reportedly read the letter from church headquarters, flung it across the table with disgust, exclaiming, "Ain't that hell?" Unquote. David O.'s doubts persisted upon arriving in Scotland. He confessed to finding it a gloomy-looking place, and I a gloomy-feeling boy. His insecurities and ambivalence intensified as a result of his appointment to be president of the Scottish Conference in June 1899. Quote, "I just seemed to be seized with a feeling of gloom and fear, lest in accepting I would prove incompetent." Unquote. But then, McKay experienced a sudden change in attitude because of two critical events. The first involved the influence of a written inscription that McKay happened upon, emblazoned on a building in the Scottish countryside. The inscription read, "Where'er thou art, act well thy part." This message struck David O. forcefully, and he decided to devote himself completely and wholeheartedly to his part, which was the role of missionary. The second event was a particularly moving missionary meeting, which he attended with a number of his fellow missionaries, a gathering presided over by James L. McMurrin, a counselor in the European Mission Presidency. As McKay later recalled, McMurrin delivered a discourse in which he directed a number of remarks toward McKay, stating, quote, "Let me say to you, Brother David, Satan hath desired you that he may sift you as wheat, but God is mindful of you." McMurrin then added, quote, "If you will keep the faith, you will yet sit in the leading councils of the church." The total experience, David O. later asserted, quote, "was the manifestation which, as a doubting youth," unquote, he had prayed for years before. McKay's long and difficult religious odyssey had the cumulative effect of further reinforcing his already strong tendencies toward self-control and self-discipline. McKay was also affected by his relationship with Emma Ray Riggs, specifically the nature of their courtship and her family's unusual ambivalent relationship with Mormonism. Both of Emma Ray's parents, Obadiah Higbee Riggs and Emma Louisa Robbins, initially had embraced the Mormon faith. In fact, in May 1867, Emma Louise and Obadiah had been married and sealed in the Endowment House in Salt Lake City. Obadiah and Emma Louise were well educated, evident in the careers of both as teachers at the University of Utah. In fact, Obadiah was appointed the first Utah Territorial Superintendent of Schools. Obadiah and Emma Louise were the parents of six children, with Emma Ray the fifth child and only daughter. But difficulties developed within the Riggs family when Obadiah sought to marry a plural wife. Initially, Emma Louise apparently consented, but then changed her mind, causing a crisis in the marriage. As a result, Obadiah left both Emma Louise and left Utah. Ultimately settling in the East, he changed professions, choosing medicine, establishing his practice in Cincinnati, Ohio. He ultimately married Hattie Fruhoff, also while living in Cincinnati, Obadiah joined the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Meanwhile, Obadiah's daughter, Emma Ray, continued to live with her mother in Salt Lake. She attended the University of Utah, graduating in 1898. Meanwhile, she met David Ho, who, along with his younger brother and two sisters, were also attending the same institution. The four McKays all lived together in a cottage, which they rented from Emma Ray's mother, Emma Robbins Riggs. David O. and Emma Ray did not immediately become romantically involved. Eventually, however, David O. took an interest in her. This occurred in 1897, near the time of his graduation, and just before his departure for missionary service. The young couple corresponded steadily for the first several months that David O. was gone, from August 1897 to March 1898. But then there was a gap of 12 months from March 1898 to March 1899. It appears that David O. and Emma Ray had completely broken off their relationship. This was the possible result of important changes in Emma Ray's life, her mother having died suddenly and unexpectedly in August of 1897 at the age of 47. Then Emma Ray left Utah, moving to Cincinnati to join her father. However, in March 1899, David O. and Emma Ray suddenly renewed their correspondence. David O. was still on his mission. Shortly thereafter, Emma Ray returned to Utah and became a teacher at Madison Elementary School in Ogden. Meanwhile, in August 1899, David O. returned home from Scotland and began to court Emma Ray in earnest. Emma Ray, however, manifested apparent ambivalence. A year and a half passed. Finally, in December 1900, David O. proposed. Emma Ray's response reflects her continuing ambivalence. Quote, "Are you sure I'm the right one?" Unquote. But David O. quickly answered in the affirmative. And just 1 month later, on the 2nd of January, 1901, David O. and Emma Ray were married in the Salt Lake Temple. David O. became the dominant figure, not just within his own immediate family, but in also directing the affairs affecting the extended McKay family. In particular, his three younger brothers, and to a lesser extent, his four sisters, who, along with their immediate families. David O.'s dominance relative to the larger McKay clan was particularly evident after 1917, in the wake of both parents' deaths. McKay, quote, "was very much the family patriarch," recalled niece Fawn Brody, adding that, quote, "he dominated all of the McKay family to an extraordinary degree, just like an old Chinese patriarch," unquote. In this mode, McKay reportedly influenced his children's choice of spouses, particularly the three oldest. But the positive aspect of David O.'s dominance was the help and influence he rendered in securing employment for various family members. One particular situation involved younger brother Thomas E. McKay, whom he aided in securing a church appointment as president of the Swiss German mission in 1938. 3 years later, David O. helped his young brother again in gaining a second appointment as an assistant to the 12. But at the same time, David O.'s success in helping his younger brother was offset by failure as a speculator in land and commodities. This failure had adverse economic consequences. In making such investments, David O., along with his three younger brothers, Thomas E., William, and Morgan, borrowed the needed funds by refinancing, that is, increasing the mortgage on the family's Huntsville farm, a property which all four had inherited jointly. The money so borrowed was in turn invested in such schemes as Arizona cotton, Tempe, Arizona citrus groves, and Canadian wheat. The McKays also speculated in cattle and land at Birch Creek near Ogden. But in every case, the investments failed. The lasting effect of all of these failures was an increase in the total mortgage debt to $35,000, a sum considered astronomical at the time. This hefty debt fell most heavily on Thomas E. McKay because he directly held the mortgage. David O's forays into speculative ventures involving the old McKay family homestead was but one aspect of the Mormon leader's strong, almost compulsive attachment to his childhood home and community. He spent as much time as possible in Huntsville when his extensive church responsibilities would permit, including weekends and time during the summer. David O. went through an annual ritual of actually living in Huntsville for 3 months each and every summer, beginning in the 19-teens and continuing into the 1950s. McKay, with his immediate family, took up residence in the old McKay family homestead. The David O. McKays did this even though they maintained their primary residence some distance from Huntsville, first in Ogden in the years immediately following David O.'s marriage, and then after 1920 in Salt Lake City. In attendance, O. McKay and his family, moving in on another family for such an extended period of time would appear to violate the essential privacy of the family affected. But Thomas E. McKay never complained, at least not openly. The Thomas E. McKay family, in fact, had no choice but to go along with this arrangement because actual ownership of the old McKay homestead was jointly held by the 8 surviving children of David and Jeanette Evans McKay through a legal entity known as the McKay Family Corporation. In this arrangement, the 8 McKay siblings each theoretically had an equal voice in making decisions affecting the homestead. But in actuality, the McKay Family Corporation was dominated by David O. To a lesser extent by the 4 McKay sisters, namely Jeanette, Elizabeth, Anne, and Catherine, who were strong, assertive, dominant personalities in their own right, all clearly taking after their late mother in this regard. In fact, 2 of the 4 sisters, Jeanette and Elizabeth, along with their families, followed the example of their older brother, the oldest brother, taking up residence in the McKay family homestead every summer, taking advantage of the cooler mountain climate, thus escaping the oppressive heat of the valleys below. While this significant influx of McKay relatives invaded the privacy of the Thomas E. McKay family, the spacious 14-room house was large enough to accommodate them all, even though the residence itself lacked the basic amenities of running water, indoor plumbing for many years. David O. McKay looked forward to his extensive stay in Huntsville as more than simply an escape from the oppressive summer heat. Time spent in Huntsville represented one of the few forms of recreation that he genuinely enjoyed. Huntsville offered McKay an idyllic temporary escape from the pressures of being a general authority. While in Huntsville, McKay assumed the role of gentleman farmer, spending a significant amount of time working some 400 acres of cultivated land and 2,000 acres of rangeland, which he shared with brother Thomas E. In particular, McKay enjoyed being with and working with his horses. His love for horses was proverbial, asserts Sister Jeanette, with his horses being, quote, more than farm animals. They were friends and treated as such. But McKay was not reluctant to wrestle the horses and give them the whip if they didn't mind, according to another family member. Also, while in Huntsville, McKay demonstrated another important skill, his ability as an effective public speaker. in evidence during services in the old Huntsville LDS meeting house. McKay was dubbed the Silver Tongue and compared with the early 20th century orator and three-time presidential Democratic presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan. Like the more famous Bryan, McKay was able to deliver a sermon on virtually any topic with grand eloquence. McKay loved to appear before an audience and spread himself around, making such oratorical performances a memorable experience for all concerned. David O's visits to Huntsville and extended stays in the old homestead also afforded him the opportunity to visit and interact with his brothers and sisters, with other McKay family members. This, in turn, gave further validation to the Mormon leader's carefully cultivated public image as a caring, empathetic family man. Certain McKay family members, however, recall a starkly different David O. Quote, "He was not a very loving man," according to niece Flora McKay Crawford, noting that he had minimal interaction with his various nieces and nephews. Quote, "He never was very loving, even to his own children, let alone his nieces and nephews," continued Crawford, adding that he was loving only to, quote, "strangers and people that he thought he could influence," unquote. Such a contrasting and starkly negative view on the part of Flora Crawford is undoubtedly due in large measure to the fact that she was both the daughter of Thomas E. McKay and the sister of Fawn McKay Brody. The particularly difficult relationship between David O. and Fawn Brody had stemmed from the latter's writing of No Man Knows My History and the firestorm it generated in the wake of its 1945 publication. This episode brought to the surface various long-standing simmering family tensions, particularly between certain members of the Thomas E. and the David O. McKay families. David O. McKay was extremely angry and upset about the whole episode, particularly over the publicity that it generated. But at the same time, he was scrupulously careful not to show it openly, even within his own family. Such behavior was in keeping with a long-standing McKay family tradition of avoiding controversy and confrontation. In conclusion, it is evident that David O. McKay was an individual of great complexity, as the above characteristics of both his public and private behavior indicates. McKay could present himself as extremely gracious, open, warm, and as a loving, empathetic individual. But in other situations, he came across less positive, that is, as a somewhat closed-minded, domineering, arrogant, and sometimes manipulative individual. But such characteristics do not diminish his accomplishments as one of the most significant, if not most important, church leader of the 20th century. Indeed, the fact that David O. McKay, through self-control and self-discipline, held in careful check all these various less admirable aspects of his persona enhances his essential greatness. Thank you.
I'd like to just take advantage of this to thank Newell for a very provocative paper. I'm always delighted to accept an invitation to be the discussant, because I don't like discussants. And so I'm going to hold my remarks fairly brief so that we can reserve the time for a discussion with all of you, because I'm sure you all have comments or questions. David O. McKay represents to me the last genuinely living prophet of the church. That may be a kind of a surprising comment. That's an autobiographical comment. David O. McKay was called as the president of the church while I was still in secondary school. And I maintained at that time that beautiful, unique, youthful faith in the church and in the prophet. I believed that he had a special channel to God, and that he received constant daily communication with God, and that the church was in good hands. When David O. McKay passed away, I was a middle-aged, mature, cynical individual, and have failed to regain that youthful faith that I possessed when he became the first the president of the church. And it's in that context that I can say he was the last genuine prophet of the church to me. This is a little bit disconcerting in certain respect. My wife and I were driving over this morning. I live here in Irvine, and she commented about David O. McKay, saying he is sort of her ideal of the prophet. And Newell characterizes that beautifully. I mean, that's the public image of David O. McKay. He's really a genuine, absolute ideal personification of what we think of when we think of the prophet and leader of the church. And so it is a little disconcerting when we hear that he had a shadow side. And as a historian, let me say, that's the role of a good historian, to clarify the fuller dimensions of an individual. David O. McKay's public image is kind of a postcard image, if you will. And it's the role of the historian to give depth and complexity to that postcard image. And I think Newell has done that beautifully. He's shown the warts. He's shown the stray hairs. He's shown the dirty clothes and so forth. And I think in my perspective, that enriches my image of a man who is also a sterling public figure. Now, I'm only going to raise one question with you, and then turn it over to you for your own responses. I think that's an important role that historians play, to clarify the full life of individuals, of historical figures and historical events. And the question that I would raise to you is the question that I find burning in today's contemporary world, where all public figures are open to the same kind of indictments, the same kind of public disclosure of their personal and private lives. And the question I raise, is that a positive, productive enterprise? I know it is it's an important enterprise of a historian. I wonder if it is a valuable enterprise of contemporary journalists, of contemporary people who are attempting to clarify the full life of our public figures. I know every public figure, including the people who are leading our church today, have a shadow side. To what degree should we uncover, clarify, disclose that kind of shadow side in their lives? To what degree should we allow them to maintain a public stance that gives them the ability to lead, to help people to be effective leaders? And that's a basic question that I have not answered to myself, but I think it's one that we all ought to address. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll open it up for questions. Are those mics working? Did you want to stand here and field questions?
Okay. Sure.
And the only thing is, repeat the question.
Sure, repeat the question in the...
Okay, yes.
Wasn't David O. McKay fairly inexperienced when he became an apostle? I think he was a second counselor and a state Sunday school superintendency, and had to be made a high priest and made an apostle. And other than J. Reuben Clark having made a high priest and made a member of the first presidency, I think that was fairly inexperienced from church leadership standpoint.
Yeah, the question is, wasn't David O. McKay fairly inexperienced when he was called to the apostleship in 1906? And if you look at him compared with other people who had been elevated to apostleships, he is very unique. And I didn't bring this out in the paper, but I think the fact that he was in the Sunday school superintendency might seem like a really big jump. You're asking a really a big jump from there to becoming an apostle, and I don't know quite how to answer why he was able to make that jump. I've alluded to it in the paper that he really moved ahead on the basis of his merits, this program of reforming the Sunday school curriculum in the Weber Stake. Really put him on the map ecclesiastically. Here was a man who was, I guess this was a whole program that was badly in need of reform. And in many ways, in reforming and streamlining the curriculum of teaching in the Sunday schools, he was really acting in the spirit of reform of progressivism at the time, which was, those currents are very much a part of the larger American society. And he was able to grab onto that. I think he had a real facility for organization and structure, having been educated, having received his degree in, I believe it was in English and education and training as a teacher, professionally trained as a teacher. So he's bringing these skills and this expertise as an expert in education reform. And I think that was enough to propel him into this leadership position. But you also have to remember that at the time he was replacing two apostles who had resigned under pressure. Carmen probably knows a little bit more about this story. I think it was Callie and Taylor. Yeah. There was that whole controversy there, and so they were looking for someone also. I don't. Somebody like McKay who would not be tainted with polygamy in any way, because it was sort of an outsider. I mean, it's sort of ironic to think of, because you look at most all of the apostles and hierarchy of the church up to that time, and they had come from within. They either were of that older generation or had family connections and everything else. And he didn't have a clear family connection with the old line families, the type of thing that Mike Quinn was talking about last night. And so he's a man who was propelled forward, not on the basis of who he was or have previously had held high church positions, but on the merits of what he had accomplished. And I think that makes him very unique at that time. And since he was the first to do that, and others, of course, that have been brought into the leadership of the church have followed in that way, being brought forward, not because they belong to one of the old line families or go back to Joseph Smith or whatever. Did that answer your question? Yeah, question back there.
You quoted Bob Rodia and her sister about him being not quite so loving to family members as he appeared to the rest of us or to the rest of society. Do you have any quotes from, I don't know how to put it, more loyal grandchildren that would confirm that?
The question is, I quoted from Fawn Brody's sister and to some extent Fawn Brody herself about the less loving side of David O. This same sense of feeling, maybe not as in stark terms, also comes from other members of the extended McKay family. I had the opportunity to interview the Gunn McKay family. They're related distantly. In fact, lived in the house. I don't know if you're familiar with Huntsville. They lived in and grew up in the house next door. They were distant cousins, even though they were both McKays. They were very distantly. And they say that there was not any love lost between the two families. In fact, there was almost a barrier. They were considered. I put it in the revised paper that there was always a distinction made between the David McKay family, including the David O. McKay family, and the Gunn McKay family who lived next door. That of course is the Congressman Gunn McKay who later went on. But it was Monroe McKay who is now who's a son of Gunn McKay, or of not Gunn McKay the Congressman, but he's a brother of Gunn McKay of that same family. And Monroe McKay, who's a federal judge, is always fond of quoting. There were the two families in Huntsville were designated as the God blessed McKays and the God damned McKays.
and everybody knew which family was which. And so there was a tension there. There was almost a certain aloofness. I think it was more aloofness that we are of special, kind of an aloofness. But I think that, as I pointed out in the paper, that that both Fawn and Flora really had some deeper seated resentment there that carried that even further. Yes.
What do you feel were the main contribution of the McKay years as president of the church, and what do you think has been lost in the contemporary church from those?
Oh, boy, you've got another half hour, 45 minutes. I think that the greatest contribution of the David O. McKay years, as I alluded to in my paper, are a couple of things. Number one, I think clearly moving the church toward an international position, you know, becoming moving it in the position to become an international church. I think that is one thing. I think the other thing, and this is something that Armin Moss discusses in his book, The Angel and the Beehive, this assimilationist or trying to reach out and interact more with the larger American society. David O. McKay, and I didn't really get to develop this in my paper, projected this image of tolerance and openness, reaching out to other peoples of other faith, to other you know, trying to break down some of the barriers that had previously existed. I don't want to use the term liberal, but more of an openness. I think a willingness to interact and that legacy. I think those two legacies are still there today, but in the latter legacy of openness and tolerance, of course, has been modified, and you know, to some extent, obviously, and you know, his niece being excommunicated is kind of an ironic thing when you really think about it. That's the one event that I, you know, really stood out with me. But at the same time, David O. McKay also expressed his willingness to see, to allow people to be open in their dialogue up to a certain point. I think there was a greater tolerance for open dialogue and discussion of issues, back then, than has evolved at the present time. I think I tend to agree with Armin Moss that the church has moved to more of a retrenchment position. In a way, I think a reaction against maybe some of the openness and assimilation of saying, if we become too assimilist, we're going to become like the RLDS church. Look at that example. You know, the church has fallen apart at the seams. And I think there's a tendency toward more of a boundary maintenance. That's another, that in a way maybe a little bit of reaction against the openness and toleration. For example, you know, David O. McKay, as you're well aware, came to the defense of Sterling McMurrin when he was under fire in the mid-1950s, even offering to testify at his excommunication trial if it ever reached that point. Of course, he didn't do it with Fawn Brody. I mean, he was actually going the other way, but that was because she was a wayward relative and she was embarrassing the family, and that's a whole different type of mode. But I think there was a willingness to of tolerance and openness that, because they talk about the fact there were the McKay men and there were the Clark, you know, J. Reuben Clark faction, and I think it's pretty clear which faction is moving more and more into the ascendancy today. Yeah.
I've often heard President McKay compared to John the 23rd.
Yeah.
I think the comparison is a little bit valid because, and my perspective, in my historical perspective, may be really limited because I'm in 20th century and I can't really see the 19th century that well. But it seems to me that during his administration, the parameters, that's President McKay, the parameters for being Mormon were much wider on the right and on the left, conservative and liberal, than they ever have been.
Yeah. I would tend to agree with you there that the parameters were wider and there was more of a tolerance and openness, reaching out to other faiths in kind of a feeling of maybe quasi ecumenicalism, not that we're going to come together, but working together on various issues. I think that ecumenicalism is still there to some extent in certain aspects of church activity, as long as those activities do not come into collision with basic doctrines or questioning of authority. Questioning of authority or questioning what the brethren direct as far as history and doctrine and stuff like that. But you know, the church today, you know, is willing to move out and work in various enterprises in partnership, you know, disaster relief and things like that. And that, you know, David O. pushed that agenda and during his presidency, and that is still a lasting legacy, I think. Yes.
Isn't this also the era of Hubie Brown, who could say to the BYU congregation that the church, or at least he personally, was more interested, he was less interested in people having orthodox ideas than he was in having ideas at all, essentially. I'm paraphrasing that. There was an openness there where he said, go ahead, it's fine to think.
Yeah, you mentioned Hubie Brown's statement that it's all right to think. David O. McKay said essentially the same thing. I wasn't able to put it in the paper, but I came across a striking quote there that it's hard for me to imagine a church leader would say that. I don't have it right in front of me. But David O. said essentially the same thing. That it's okay to think, it's okay to inquire, and I think part of that was because David O. McKay, unlike some of the other apostles and some of the other hierarchy of the church, particularly people like Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, and people who were caught up in doctrine and dogma. Yeah, David O. was never really that imbued or interested in dogma or doctrine. He accepted unquestionably certain basic tenets of Mormonism, but he wasn't thrusting on the membership a rigid catechism of how those dogmas or doctrines. It was kind of an open-ended type of thing. A little bit like the old English saying, as long as you don't do it in the street and scare the horses, it's okay. I think there was a little bit. I don't know. I think there was a little bit of that in David O. McKay. Yes, back there.
Would you elaborate on the appointments of Thomas to the church position? And how does that fit with the bad, whatever we call it, between the?
Well, the question is Thomas E. McKay's appointments and relationship with his brother. That was a very complex relationship, and I didn't really get a chance to go into it in more detail in the paper because it's more germane to the work I've been doing on Fawn Brody. But the relationship between the two families, actually Thomas E. and David O. really were very close and got along very well. And there was kind of a mutually supportive relationship there between the two brothers. There was a symbiotic relationship. And so from what I've read and talking to various family members, I didn't come across any evidence at all of any animosity between David O. and Thomas E. McKay. But where the resentment developed was between Thomas E. McKay's family, namely his wife, Fawn Brimhall McKay, and the daughters, particularly the daughters, because they felt that their father was being dominated by David O. And to some extent that was true, because David O. was the older brother, and he was a more dynamic, more charismatic personality, more assertive. And so that dynamic was there. But they saw it as that Thomas E. was weak-willed and unwilling to stand up for his own family and things like I've mentioned in this paper. And so certain tensions developed between the family of Thomas E., specifically Fawn Sr. and Fawn Jr., you know, the mother and daughter. There was a nexus of resentment there. And that fermented, and I think that had a lot to do with the way that Fawn Brody went, because she was a product of that anger and that resentment. I think No Man Knows My History was directed as much against David O. as it was against the Mormon Church. The more and more I look at it, the more that this was a way of her being able to strike back at David O. because he felt that he had dominated and cowed over their side of the family. I don't know if that answers your question.
Time for one more quick one.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask about you mentioned this McMurrin on a mission that had a strong spiritual experience with him. Is he related?
I haven't been able to establish a clear relationship there. I didn't have a chance to trace the genealogy. First, I thought it might be, the question is this James McMurrin related to Sterling McMurrin? There, I believe there is a relationship, but it's not a father-son relationship because his father had a different first name. I think it might be an uncle. But I'm not absolutely positive. I when I was writing the paper, I didn't get a chance to really trace out the genealogy. But I think he was an uncle. But I'm not absolutely positive about that. Yeah, I suspect it did because I think part of the same family, and it is Scottish. You know, there was a close relationship, and I really strongly suspect that later came back to help Sterling in his situation. Okay, I guess time is up. I guess that's it. Thank you very much.